He said we'd like to have a report on India. You've been there recently. Some of us have been looking forward to India as a possible place of work, and we'd like to have as fresh news from there as possible. But in the half hour or so that I have, let me first of all fill you in as to how we happen to go there. Food for the Hungry is a $10 million organization that has been taking food to the places on earth where there is great hunger. And Food for the Hungry has a conviction that hunger is not merely physical hunger, it's also spiritual hunger. And of the two, spiritual hunger may be more devastating than physical hunger. And so part of its program is to encourage the growth of the church. For example, about 10 months ago, it took 2 million pounds of food to Poland. And it said to the communist government there, we're not going to send Americans over here to distribute it. And we're not going to ask you Marxists to distribute it. We're not going to ask the Roman Catholics to distribute it. But there are about 200 evangelical churches here. We're going to ask them to distribute it. Does this meet with your approval? And the government said, fine. Just so long as they distribute to the people who really need it. And we know them and we believe they'll do that. Well, that was done. And the food was distributed. Most of it went to the Roman Catholics. Some of it went to the Marxists. A very small amount of it went to the evangelicals, because that's the way they are in the population. But after that, the interest of the people in the gospel and in the evangelical churches increased very markedly, very markedly. And there were quite a large number of accessions to the evangelical churches. Well, Food for the Hungry said to me, will you conduct a series of church growth seminars in Asia? Three in Japan, Tokyo, Osaka, and Kobe. Kobe, by the way, is the largest port in the world. But you hear that and you just sort of wonder, but I'm told that it's true. And then we went down to Thailand and had quite an effective church growth seminar there. Then on to Bangladesh, and 300 people gathered there. And that was a very good seminar. Then to Madras, India. And then one in London, it was quite widely attended. And then one, of all places, in Northern Ireland, up on the northernmost tip of Northern Ireland. It was cold there in December, let me assure you. And but we had a very good, warm seminar there. Well, in India, I count Dhaka, Bangladesh, as really part of India. It used to be called Bengal, you know. And it's an essential part of India, the great rivers of India. The Ganges and the Brahmaputra flow out through Bangladesh. It's like Mississippi and Louisiana are part of the United States. So there is very considerable growth of the church in about five or six patches, five or six segments of society. The Garos, the Khasis, the greatest growth is amongst the Santals, the Nomo Shudras, the Telugus, and one or two others. Otherwise, the 15 or 20 million Hindus and the 75 or 80 million Muslims, the population there is exploding like this. I used to think there are 70 million people in Bangladesh. They tell me that now it's close to 100 million. And a few years from now, it's going to be 150 million. Most of the people there, if they hear the gospel at all over the radio, or in tracts, or hear some preaching on the street corner, they dismiss it. This has nothing to do with us. But there are a few segments of the population who, when they hear it, they say, this is good news for us. And we shouldn't be surprised at this, because this is the way that Christianity started, you know. As the Lord and his apostles preached it in Palestine, Everybody heard. But the only people who really believed in any considerable numbers were the common people. Not many Pharisees, not many scribes, not many Sadducees, not many rulers of the people, certainly no Italians or Arabians or Egyptians. There was a fairly small segment of the population that listened to the gospel. It's always that way. And as you go out as missionaries, you find that happening no matter what country you go to. There will be segments of the population responding. Then we went down to Madras. And in Madras, which is on the southeast coast of India, pretty well down toward the southland, the important thing is that there are a lot of Christians there. It's a big city, 2-3 million people, lots of industry, and a teeming place, absolutely crowded, jammed with people. And among the Christians, there are many churches, and much going to church from amongst the Christians, but relatively little becoming Christians amongst non-Christians. No matter what the denomination, the Pentecostals are making the greatest, are being most effective in their evangelism. With one exception. That exception is a small outfit called the Evangelical Church of India. It's a rather big name for a rather small outfit. The Evangelical Church of India. Well, it is an evangelical denomination. 17 years ago, it was 700 in number. It is now 17,000. They've been baptizing about 1,000 a year. And since they baptize only believers, that means that the total community grows about 2,000 a year. Now there again, it isn't just everybody. A few from here, a few from there, a few from here. The people who are flooding in, they will tell you, are Hurrians. But that again is a very big name, covering a lot of castes. There's just one caste from which most of the converts come. And what has happened is then that the leaders of the evangelical church have seen ways of reaching the particular segment of the population that is now women. They don't pay much attention to the other segments of the population. Oh, if they come to church, they're very nice, you know, so glad you came, please come again, that sort of thing. But the people who are hearing the gospel and accepting it, like the common people of Jerusalem did, when the scribes didn't, the Pharisees didn't, the Sadducees didn't, the rulers of the people didn't, then Pilate didn't, then the Romans didn't, the Egyptians didn't, the common people did. The people who are hearing and accepting of one fairly small segment of the population. But amongst them, there's a frame of mind, let's become Christians. Let's become Christians. And so sometimes 20, sometimes 40, sometimes 100, sometimes 400. 400 was baptized in the sea recently. Accept the Lord, return to their homes, carry on the jobs that they had before, and they're finding an interesting thing. Where there are city churches, they can support their pastors. In the country, in the villages, these are landless laborers. And they cannot support an educated pastor. So what they're saying to the educated pastors is, you run an English school. That's where you make your money. You charge fees, and the well-to-do people in the villages will send their children to you to learn English. That's where you get your income. But your real job is pastoring this church. So you see there are many different ways of going about fast and effective. Then we left Madras, and in Madras we had a church with a seminar, about 200 people attended. Students, ministers, laymen, those who were interested in the growth of the church and who were seeing this particular case of it, and are are saying to themselves, why can't we do likewise? And after being there and studying the situation, it was my conviction that many of them could do likewise if they wanted to. No, I will qualify that. They wanted to. If they wanted to and knew how to. If they wanted to and did the right things. There are plenty of people who won't escape. Even when they get out of the ice, they fall down. You've got to know how to do it. And if they want to and know how to do it, there is much growth to be had. I ran across a large caste down there called the Marwas. These are the descendants of the armies of the Chola kings 600-800 years ago. And they are a fairly martial lot. They have swords and knives and spears and occasionally a gun in their houses. And they are reputed to be a very rough lot. Well, amongst them in several different places are now small Christward movements. Sometimes a few hundred, sometimes a thousand, a few, sometimes 20 or 30. And that's another responsive group, provided it's cultivated the right way. They think they're considerably above the Harijans. And if the gospel is presented to them by a preacher, whom they know he's a Harijan, they don't pay much attention. That's one reason why missionaries, foreigners, have been particularly effective in preaching the gospel. Particularly if the missionary could say, I was in the army once. And, hey, they say, this is a real man. Let's listen to him. Something of this sort goes on. Now, you'd never thought of that as part of the missionary task, but one's got to find out what it is that appeals to them, what it is that they listen to, what it is that commends the gospel to them. And believe me, one of the convictions that I have as I come back from this tour is that the day of the missionary is far from over. The day of the missionary in many ways is just beginning. And the fact that in America we are people of such wealth and such freedom and such power as a nation doesn't handicap the gospel then. Indeed, it earns a kind of a respect for the missionary from this land. Then from there we went on to the place where Ms. McGavern and I worked as missionaries for 30 years, right in the heart of India. You put your finger down on the center of the map and you'd cover the area that we worked in. And we visited our former places of residence and met with people who were dear friends, co-workers, fellow ministers, teachers in schools, cultivators in the field, and the reason we went was to see what the circumstances of the work were. The thing there that struck me most forcibly was that there had been practically a complete failure of the range. The rice, there was no rice. Even the straw, they hadn't harvested straw, which means that the cattle in May and June and July will die because there will simply be no food for them. And the people are going to be in very bad shape. And so I, coming home, I wrote to the people who are in touch with that work and urged that they send out famine relief to be very carefully administered so that those who don't need it don't get it. But those who do need it do get it. Now, that's just a report of what we did when we went. But let me mention three things that I think would be of interest to this group. The first is, and three or maybe four things, the first is the tremendous need of India. India now has 700, pushing 800 million people. And there's no end to the population. It's a land that is crowded with people. It is particularly noticeable in the big cities. You get out in the countryside, it's not so noticeable. There's still lots of open land. There's still lots of forest. But in the cities, you will never see as crowded cities. In Bombay, if we went to the airport and fell into the young man who'd just come out from Holland, he was in a state of shock. He said he hadn't slept for 3 nights. It just struck him as so incredible, so impossible, so terrible. Well, India is crowded, and its need is tremendous. Now, its need is physical, not so much. I don't think there's very much actual hunger that produces death. There'll be some hungry people around. And education has spread enormously in the last 30 years. Practically all the boys go to school, not all the girls. And in the villages, not all the boys do. But education is very widespread. Colleges have increased. There are more college graduates in India than there are in England. And probably more in India than there are in England and France combined. There are a lot of educated people there. And the health on the whole is good. Smallpox has been wiped out. Malaria, however, has come back in. The mosquitoes almost got, malarial mosquitoes almost got wiped out with the DDT around 1950. And they stopped DDT, and the mosquitoes came back, and malaria came back. It's fairly common. The need there, however, primarily is spiritual. There has been, idolatry is very widespread. You see people making offerings to idols. A mechanical sort of pouring milk over a shapeless stone that is the god, in the hope that if we do that, it will be good for us. Fear of evil spirits. And then amongst the educated classes, there's a great wave of secularism. But all this religion is nonsense. There aren't any gods. These idols are nothing. There aren't any evil spirits. Whatever is done by men. Well, that's well known in America and the Western world. We too are engulfed by secularism and materialism. And the educated people are part of that. And the ordinary people are wrapped up in idolatry. And the spiritual need is very great. Now there's some 18 million Christians there. And some people in the Western world, the older missionary society, say, well, we can leave everything with the younger church. We planted the church. It's there. And the church will do it. The day of the missionary. The imperialistic missionary. The paternalistic missionary. It's all over. Now we leave it to the church. Well, if the church were to exert itself 101%. They wouldn't reach a temple. And frankly, those churches there, just like these churches here, don't exert themselves 101%. They don't exert themselves 100%. They don't exert themselves 50%. They don't exert themselves 25%, just like the churches in Pasadena. They don't do all they can. They just do a part of it. So that the church is there, they are reaching some. But as I said in Madras, of all the churches, there's only one that is really in the midst of a big, going, growing Christward movement. That's the church called the Evangelical Church of India. So that we've got to turn away from this entrancing concept that the day of the Western missionary is over, now we'll leave it to the nationals. If the nationals do it, and some of them do, we'll help them on occasion. But the missionary doesn't go abroad to help the under churches. The missionary goes abroad to tell the gospel to the people who don't know. Now I hope you'll says that would be written in letters of fire on their mind. The missionary does not go to help the younger church. Some of us will go over and we'll teach in seminaries where leaders of the younger church come. That's right. Perhaps a quarter of missionaries should help the younger church, because the younger church doesn't get fully developed for a good many years, maybe a few decades. Some of us should go to help the younger church, but the great bulk of missionaries, whether it's 3/4 or 2/3, doesn't make a difference, 9/10, 1/2. The great bulk of missionaries should go to plant the church where the church isn't. And the church isn't in very, very large sections of the community. In India, I was talking to a fine educated man who was telling me with great enthusiasm that he planted a church, 120 members, in a city that he and I knew very well. And I congratulated him, and we were pleased, and I praised him for his work. And then I said, of these 120, how many are Christians who moved there from other places? Oh, he said, about 100, maybe 110. So that he may have had 10 converts. What he was really getting was transfer growth. What he was really doing was gathering up scattered, battered Christians who had moved to that city. And that is necessary work. It has to be done. He was doing a good job. I'm glad he was doing it. But we must not think that the younger churches are going to do the job. It's too big. It has too many sides. It has too many angles. And the caste system in India, there's no country in the world that has a more closely defined and a more closely defined social system with more rigid walls, where everybody knows his status. And you know who's below you, and you know those castes who are above you. And most of the Church of India has come in from the bottommost castes. They've come in from what used to be called the untouchables. Now they're called the Harijans, or the scheduled castes. And respectable caste people, even if they believe on Jesus Christ, are not about to join churches made up of people who for generations they have thought these are below us. So that's part of the picture. We've got not merely taken Kerala, which is the southwest tip of India. There, a fifth of the people, 20%, are Christian. And Kerala is the one state in India from which quite a large number of upper caste people have become Christian. They are the Syrian Christians. They follow the Syrian rite. 2.5 million, maybe more, 3 million, let's say. And one of the respectable castes are called Nayars. From amongst the Nayars, practically nobody's become a Christian. Because to become a Christian would mean to join the Syrian community and marry a Syrian girl and eat with Syrians at table and have intimate relationships with Syrians, not with us Nayars. In other words, we have to join them, not us. So very few Nayars have become Christians. And I said to some of the Syrians when I was over there, why don't you start Nayar churches? Oh, they said, we'd be very pleased if any Nayars would join us. I said, that's not what I said. They said, why don't you join start a Nayar church where Nayars will join other Nayars in church? It was a new idea to them. But were that to be done, then the becoming Christian of the Nayars would become very much easier. Would get very much more possible. Well, the first thing I want to lay on your conscience is the spiritual need, very widespread. He is not being met by the younger church, despite the fact that the younger church is doing some very good things. The second thing I would lay on your heart is that as you estimate the situation in any country, in any city, in any mission field, in any place of work. See it quantitatively. Until you see it quantitatively, you do not know what's going on. Until you see it quantitatively, you don't know what's going on. For example, in Madras, I have been hearing for years about a certain church, which is well known in this country, Church in Madras, a congregation. Members of that congregation go out and evangelize on the streets. They sell tracts. They have revival services in the church. It's a good, warm, spirit-filled church. And they do a lot of evangelism. But when you ask them, how many converts have you had? There's a sudden, strange silence. They've had practically none. They're not geared for that. They're not geared for that. And it's in that very same city that Ezra Sargon's outfit, the Evangelical Church of India, has grown from 700 to 17,000 in 15 years. And until you know the quantitative aspects, you cannot. If you didn't know the quantitative aspects, you'd say, well, this church that's so spirit-filled and so well, always doing evangelism and out on the streets and bearing witness to Christ and testifying and this, that, and the other thing. You would say, that is really, this is the church that's getting through. It isn't. It's doing a lot of things, but it isn't getting through. You've got to find out who's getting through. Go back to Bangladesh, there's another illustration there. I was in a church a week or so ago, and they said, well, the minister was saying I was in Bangladesh 6-8 months ago, and the National Christian Council there told us that there really was no need for missionaries in Bangladesh today, that the church is doing the job. I said, was he of the National Christian Council? He said, yes. Immediately I know the situation, because in Bangladesh, two denominations only form the National Christian Council. One is the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, and the other is a branch of the Baptist Church. And they have 1/4 only of all the Christians. 3/4 of the Christians, during the last 5 or 6 years, have branched off to become an evangelical national organization. That was the one that attended the church growth seminar. And when they spoke to me, they said, we've got 50 missionaries here and we wish we had 500 more. There's much work to be done. Until you know the quantitative aspects, you don't really know what's happening. So as you pray to the Lord where to go, as you search where to go, as you study where to go, as you visit these places, try to get as accurate a picture as you can as to where the church is actually growing, where converts are being won, and where there's a lot of good work going on, but not much progress. Now the third thing that we want to mention that had been put on me during my India visit is that we missionaries simply must look, search for, hunt for receptive people. India isn't just full of Indians. India is full of 3,000 kinds of Indians. India is a mosaic. There are many different pieces. There are many different segments of the population. A few segments are receptive. Most segments are indifferent. A few segments are hostile. And I like to think that those didn't become receptive by accident. That God turned them receptive. And when a field is ripened, that's the field you ought to reap. When you start to reap a green field, or a field that hasn't been sown, you won't bring back much grain. You'll bring back grain if you reap a ripe field. We've got to see what are the ripe segments of the population. We've got to see what are the segments which can be won. We've got to see what those groups of people are who, when they hear the gospel, say, I want to know